something that we're unaware of, that our society is filled with crippled families. And I believe that it's partly due to the deterioration of the quality and the character of the men who are supposed to be leading them. Quality and character develops among people who have ideals. And the tragedy of the American family, I believe, is that we do not. Our society has no dreams for itself. It has no vision of what it can become. It only seeks what it can get. Men are not driven to be better husbands because they have abandoned the models, I believe, that God has left for them. But I have confidence tonight that I'm speaking to people who have not abandoned the ideals of God. And I hope that this study will be an encouragement to you, and that maybe some things that I can offer would be just a little bit, be something that would help us take a step further in becoming what we need to be. The first really point that I want to make tonight, we're talking about the ideal husband. And the first point that I want to make tonight to you is that in my study, I found that a Christian husband is a man who is committed to ideals. God has given us a model of how things ought to be. And an idealist is, when I became a Christian, I became an idealist. A man who seeks for things as they ought to be. Who thinks in terms of how we ought to be, not how we are. And one who would live his life relentlessly pursuing and following after the models and the dreams and the ideals that God has laid out for us. That is what we are supposed to be. That's what we said when we said that I will follow the Lord, that I will be a follower of Christ, is we said we will become idealists, one who seeks after what we ought to be, the dreams that God has had for us. God dreamed that those who would love Him would be conformed to the image of His Son in Romans chapter 8, verse 28 and 29, that we would become pattern ourselves after the character of His Son, Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11. Is that your dream for yourself? Is that what you've set as your goal in life? To conform yourself after the image of God's Son? That's what He dreamed for you. And we must choose that for ourselves. Jesus is the model. He is the ideal. He is what God wanted for every man from the beginning. He is the ideal for the husband. He's the ideal for the wife. And He's the ideal for the child. And it's interesting, over the last few months I did a study in the book of Matthew. And the portrait that I saw in that book that came out of Jesus is not like the portraits we see on so many people's walls of some fellow with long hair and a beard and kneeling down praying. That's not the portrait you get. You get the portrait of a character, of a type of individual, a man that has certain qualities of character such as humility, trust, commitment, honor, goodness, kindness, submissiveness. That's what you get when you look at the portrait that the gospel writers painted for us of Jesus. That is the ideal. That is what we're to conform our lives to and to spend our whole lives working for. And the ideal husband is to be one like Jesus Christ. Our text tonight is in Ephesians chapter 5 and verses 23 through 33. I'd like to read that with you just first of all. Paul says in this section that what the husband is to the wife, Christ is to the church. And so what I suggest to you is if we can look at Jesus and see how He fulfilled His role as a husband, then we can know what we're to do. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 23. It says, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, He Himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for her, that He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that He might present to Himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Paul, in this text, seems to say if we look at the husband and the wife, we should be able to then understand Christ as his role as the husband to the church. But I think we can turn that around and say that if we can see what Christ is to the church, we can understand what the husband is to be to the wife. And when you read this section, this text, there seem to me to be two major points that came out as far as the role that Christ has to the church. Number one, he is the leader. And number two, he's the lover. And I want to look at those two parts of his role tonight in our study. First of all, let's talk about Christ's headship. His headship. The leader as the leader of the family. As the head of the house, I think a lot of times men tend to get the idea that we can just about do anything we want. That we can define our role as the head of the house. However we see that should be the case. I say that's wrong. I don't believe, from my study, that we even have the liberty to define what our role is as the head. It has already been defined for us by the qualities of Christ's headship as he leads the church. And there are three aspects of the headship of Christ as a leader over the church, over his bride. And I want you to think about those with me. Number one is that Christ, he leads to serve. He leads to serve. Look, if you would, first of all, to Matthew chapter 20 and verse 28. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 28. Some of the other passages I won't turn to, I'll leave those for you to maybe make notes on and read for yourself. But there's just a few passages that lay down some very important principles that I'd like you to consider. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 28, Jesus said to his apostles, "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Jesus came to serve. He came here to serve even to the point of death, he said. And when you think about that, there is absolutely no self-interest in that whatsoever. Jesus did not come here to get his way. And in fact, in this very discussion, in this chapter, he tries to get his apostles to understand that in the kingdom of God, it is not a quest for who can be boss. It is a quest for who can serve the other the most. Husbands, we need to... It seems like when you look at Christ as a leader of his bride, we have to look at what we can put into a marriage instead of what we can get out of it. Headship is governed by the principle of seeking the best interest in the one who follows and not our own. You ask a wife. She has to submit to her husband. That's her command. That's her duty. But you ask her, which is easier to submit to? To a man where all of his actions are colored by a total interest in her spiritual and emotional and physical well-being, or to a man who is totally interested in himself? Which is it easier to submit to? But Jesus was a man whose headship was characterized by serving. But the second thing about his headship that stood out to me was he leads by his example. He leads his bride by example. 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 22 and 23. We'll read verse 21 as well. 1 Peter chapter 2 says, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return, and while suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to the one who judges righteously. Jesus leads His bride. He left an example for His bride, for the church. First of all, by His example. One way, by His example. And in this text, He left His example of how we should live in the world. How we should conduct ourselves as husbands in the world. When He faced His accusers, He was blameless. His speech was blameless. His conduct was noble and honorable. He didn't sling mud with them. He didn't roll in the mud with those people. Isaiah said, like a lamb before the shearer is silent, so He did not open His mouth. You know, the world is ungrateful. It's arrogant. It's boastful. It's insensitive. It's critical. But that's the nature of the beast. We shouldn't be surprised at that. The fact of the matter is, we are to be a different kind of people. We are to be different and always maintain a controlled spirit. Not easily set on edge, never striking back, never quick-tempered to retaliate. That was Christ's example to His bride of how to conduct themselves in the world. But also, He was an example, He led by His example even in the home, even among those who were His. You think of the single thing that seemed to stand out the most in the minds of His disciples when He was with them. What was it that impressed them the most about Jesus? It seemed to me like it was His prayer life. I mean, when they said, Lord, teach us how to pray, like John taught His disciples in Luke chapter 11 and verse 1. I would suggest to you that as husbands, one thing that our bride needs to see us doing is spending a lot of time in prayer. She needs to see us praying in the home, and that's not just at dinner three times a day. She needs to see us studying God's Word and feeding off of that. I'll tell you what it says to her. It says to her where your priorities lie. And that's one thing that Jesus' disciples never misunderstood about Him. They understood where His priorities were, and that's what our bride needs to see with us, I believe. But a third thing that He did, as far as guiding by His example, was in His example of submission. Jesus said in many times, He said that my will is to do the will of Him who sent me. He said it is to accomplish His work. Jesus was the ultimate example to His bride, to those who would follow Him, to the church, in what it means to submit. So many times we're so concerned about our wives and how they got this concept of submission down. Do you have the concept down? You know, if we spend our time submitting to our Father like Jesus did to His, there'll be no question. Our brides will have a wonderful example of what that's all about. I learned one thing from this study, is that Jesus never subdued His bride. It is not the husband's job to subdue the bride. It's not our job to make our wife submissive. In Psalm 110 and verse 3, it seems like that the psalmist was trying to teach it, made the statement that thy people will volunteer freely in the day of thy power. You know, that's her job. She'll take care of that. But we can set an example by submitting ourselves to our Father. And as we learned in the first part of the, back in Ephesians chapter 5, it said, submit yourselves one to another. A husband's job is to submit just like a wife. We spend our whole life submitting to our brethren, submitting to our wives and helping them in the ways that God's taught us to help them. But Jesus is our example. He's the ideal. Is that our dream for ourselves, to be like Him, to lead by in the way that He led His bride? But there's a third way that Jesus' headship was characterized, and that was He was the guardian and protector. He was a guardian and protector of His wife. Look over, if you would, in 1 Peter chapter 2. You should be there in verse 25. There Peter said, for you are continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. That's to Jesus. But if you look over to one other passage in John chapter 10, to another image that Jesus used to describe His relationship to those who followed Him, that was of a shepherd and his sheep. And in verse 11 of that chapter, Jesus said this. He said, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hireling and not a shepherd is not a shepherd, who is not the owner of the sheep, beholds the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hireling and is not concerned about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me. Jesus demonstrates his leadership of his bride, his sheep, by being a guardian and protector. And I'd suggest to you that maybe sometime I think when I listen to guys talk that we've misunderstood our role as shepherds sometime over the flock that we've been given charge over. We tend to think only in terms of physical protection. We're worried about those burglars and thieves and intruders, and well, we're ready to take those on if they ever come into the house. But I don't think that's the emphasis that we ought to see in that. I mean, just think about it. If you have your family ready to go to heaven, I pray that nothing ever like that happens, any kind of tragedy to any one of them. But if you lose one of those of your family in that sense, they just got to heaven before you did. That's not what your job is, I don't think, as a leader, as a husband, and a protector. I think we're to provide a refuge for our brides, a refuge for the wife, a fold so that she can be safe from the world, a place where the world and ungodliness are shut out, a place where the wife can feel secure from the world outside. We have to maintain, I believe, an atmosphere of love and peace in our homes where our wife can grow into all that God intended her to be. That's our task, I think, as a guardian and protector. If you have chosen to be a husband, it seems like to me that we've chosen to go to war, but not a physical war, a spiritual war. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, that we know so well. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, where Paul said, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places." The husband's job, I believe, is to recognize the spiritual threats and eliminate them. If the TV becomes a threat to your family, you're to eliminate. It's not there. It's a danger. You are to understand what is on the TV and what is being shown so that you can regulate what's watched and brought into your home. If recreation and entertainment becomes something that your family is consumed with, something that we think we always, and that's the devil's, some of his greatest tools right now, is that we are so consumed by the desire to be entertained. And if a husband sees that that's the direction that his family is going, and they have no sober consideration of this, of what they're here for, then it is his job to somehow work through his family that he can eliminate that threat. If busyness becomes a part of our family and we're consumed by it, working hours where we have no time for our family, no time for Bible study, no time for prayer together, and that, again, Gary Henry did a series of lessons that are so wonderful called the tools that the devil is using against us. And one of his whole lessons was on busyness. If Satan can just crowd our schedule so much that God is pushed out, he's won the battle. He can take us to hell just as fast that way as he can sending you out in the world to do things that are wicked. The husband's job is to eliminate that threat. We are the guardian and protector of our families in a spiritual sense, I believe. Stephen Farrar did a book called Point Man, and he said that leading a family through the chaos of the American culture is like leading a small patrol through enemy-occupied territory. Maybe some of the men here have a small idea of what a point man is. My father-in-law happens to have been in the Vietnam War several years ago. For two tours in Vietnam, he was a point man. And he told me some things about that role that he had of leading this small patrol through those jungles. And he made some very practical observations that kind of tie in to what we're talking about tonight. He said one thing to me. He said that mistakes were so deadly and so costly to the man who was leading that patrol. He said that a lot of times the point man may survive, but it was the ones who were following him who died. There were mines, he said, that a point man's job was to be able to anticipate ambushes, to find trip wires, to find the mines that were laying through the jungles so that he could lead his patrol around them. And he said that when you tripped one of those mines, when it exploded, the man who was in front, the point man, may be hit in some of the lower extremities, but those mines sort of worked like a garden hose. When you hold it up and spray it in the air, you know, the man who sprays it doesn't get wet, but the film, the kind of wave of the water behind, will hit everybody behind him. And he said those mines sort of worked like that. And I thought about Lot and his family. I thought about that point man who led his family into Sodom. And he survived. He did okay. He was tortured by it. 2 Peter tells us that it burdened his soul greatly because of the challenges there. It said in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 6, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. And then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from the temptation. Lot survived that, but his family didn't. He lost every one of them. It's a dangerous job, being a point man, and mistakes can be costly. But he also told me, my wife's father told me about the danger of going to sleep. He said it was so deadly at night when the patrol would camp in the woods and they would want to sleep in the jungle, but someone had to stay awake. Somebody had to stay on guard the whole time. Always be watching. And he said there was one man in his patrol that always had a tendency to fall asleep, and it frightened him to death. And it would get your patrol killed. And when he told me about that, I thought about Noah. I thought about another point man who led his family valiantly through one of the most wicked times the world has ever known. He led his family through the greatest disaster the world has ever known, the flood. And then he came out on the other side, survived, and then he got drunk and went to sleep. And one of his sons saw him naked. And you know the rest of the story. It was because a point man fell down on his job. He fell asleep. He let his guard down when time seemed really easy and there was no problem. And it cost some of his family their lives. And I thought about the disciples in the garden when Jesus was praying the night before he died. And he told them, he said, watch and pray, so that you don't fall into temptation. And he prayed desperately that God would, you know, help him through this. What did the disciples do? They went to sleep. They weren't worried about it. They had it all figured out. They were just sure that Jesus was going to conquer any enemies that would challenge them, that they would rise up and be his next sinner and establish a great army and rule. They weren't worried about anything. They just went to sleep. Deadly. He tries to teach us, watch. Don't go to sleep. And the point man needs to know that that's his job, to be watching. We get so dull sometimes, the more I think about it. We don't worry about things. We're not alert and attentive and on guard against every kind of spiritual threat there could be to our families. And the reason is because we don't fear the enemy. The reason my father-in-law said that he survived is because he was so afraid of the enemy. But we don't fear. And because we don't fear, we become dull in our senses. And that's exactly what the Hebrew writer was rebuking that church that he was writing to in chapter 5 and verse 14 when he said that your senses are supposed to be trained. The mature should be trained to discern good and evil. And those men, they were getting dull. They weren't paying attention to what was going on. He told me another thing about a point man. He said that you have to always proceed with caution with the patrol that's following you. That you can't be anxious. You can't rush into things. Or you're going to hit that tripwire. And you're going to cost your family their life. Two men did that my father-in-law was leading. They were ambitious. They were anxious. They didn't want to wait for him to lead them. And they just kept badgering him because they wanted to move on at a faster pace. And he finally said, then you lead us. You just take over and lead us. They hadn't gone 200 yards, and one of the men tripped a mine and found his lungs filled with shrapnel. And his dad, her dad, held the man as he died in his arms. And it really made an impact on him. And I guess the lesson, again, was kind of that the point, man, is to set the pace. The leader of the family, you set the pace. And you proceed with caution through this American chaos, as Steve Farrar dubbed it. Maintain your position. Don't give it up when those who follow you are not quite as patient as they ought to be and willing to follow your lead. Don't give it up. They are to follow. They've chosen that. We can't trade our positions off. It could cost others their lives. And then finally, he said one other thing that kind of reminded him that he was reminded of as he was a point man in those jungles was that you couldn't stop for too long in one place. That you had to keep moving. That when you stopped in the jungles, you would get mortared. The enemy would spot you and they would mortar you. And he said you had to keep them moving through the jungles to the other side, to your goal. And that reminded me of Jacob, a point man who was supposed to lead his family from Laban's house back to Bethel. That was his vow to God. God said, you go back to Bethel where you were supposed to go. But he stopped in Shechem on the way. And he built a house there. And tragedy came to his family because of that. He stopped for too long. His daughter was raped. His sons massacred a city. He failed in his job. And I guess of all those stories, you know, that he told me, the point was that it's so, you have an incredible responsibility, we who have chosen to be husbands. That we have a job to lead our wives, but they are to be led very carefully and cautiously and with a fear of the enemy that we're dealing with. But as I thought about that, it seemed to me like a man thrives on that part of his role as a husband. One book called him the Man of Steel, who gets to exercise those qualities of great leadership, firmness, decisiveness, decisive judgment, courage, steadfastness. But there's another side of the role that we tend to overlook, or at least we get really careless and sloppy about a lot of times. And that is the way this man titled his book, A Man of Steel and Velvet. And he said that we are to have a kindly consideration for those who he is leading. Gentleness, tenderness, selflessness, patience. And Jesus is the ideal. He's the model in that aspect of the role of the husband as well. He's not only the leader, but he's the lover. And so I want to talk to you for just the last few minutes tonight about the other side of this element of the role of the husband, and that is Christ's love for his bride. Christ's love for his bride. I thought this would probably be the hardest point of the lesson for me because I thought it's the part I know the least about. But then I thought, no, not really. Because it's a very common practice for the men when they're courting, when they're dating. We're the best we can ever be. Treating our spouses, or rather our fiancés, kindly and gently and patiently and all of those sort of things. But we kind of let that lapse when we get married. And we begin to take that aspect of our role as a husband for granted, it seems to me. But Jesus didn't. His role as in his love for his bride constantly is a love that is, number one, sacrificial. Ephesians chapter 5 again, our text, kind of brought that out. Ephesians chapter 5 in verse 25, husbands, he says, love your wives as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. The love that Christ shows for his bride is the love that we must show for our brides if we are following the ideal, if we are patterning our lives after the ideals. It is a love that's sacrificial. It's giving up something of personal value for the benefit of another. Jesus gave up his life, but he also gave up his time. He gave up his place with God. He gave up his rights to come and serve us. What is your passion? Basketball? Golf? Racing, fixing cars maybe, tennis, sleeping late on Saturday morning, Watching the news at 11 at night, watching David Letterman, going hunting, fishing, that's my passion. How willing are you, though, and how often do you give up those things for some much-needed time with her? Do you pitch a fit? Do you roll your eyes in disgust, breathe heavily? I mean, you may do it, but do you do it reluctantly when she wants that time with her? There's one word that describes that kind of attitude. It's selfishness. But there's another. Jesus was one who demonstrated himself as one who loved his bride and sacrificed for her. We did that when we were dating him. We did that when we were courting them. There was nothing that we weren't willing to sacrifice to spend time with them. Jesus is still sacrificing. Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 25. He ever lives to make intercession for us. That's his job. He didn't just retire when he was raised from the dead. He went back to work. And he spends his time sitting and waiting to petition God on our behalf and to intercede for us. That's sacrifice. But also, there's another part of his love that stood out to me, and that was that he had a love that nourishes from our text in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 28. Husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it. He nourishes. I thought, if I was to add up all the money that I spent this fall on things for hunting and fishing, clothes, tags, permits, lures, arrows, everything was essential too. It was just essential to do those things. And then I compared it to how much I'd spent on my wife, to buy her a new jacket or some things for her hair or a new dress, take her out to eat or buy some earrings. I'd be ashamed. In fact, I won't add it up. I won't do it because it spells in big, bold print selfishness. Again, it spells selfishness. Our wives are to be provided for, it seems like to me, not starved. When Jesus said in Ephesians chapter 1, or when Paul wrote, Jesus said through Paul in Ephesians chapter 1 in verse 7 and 8, he said, "In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses, according to the riches of his grace, which he lavished upon us." You know, Jesus, God has poured out so much upon us. He has blessed us so abundantly. He can't hardly give us enough, nourishing us and taking care of us. How much less should we have of that attitude toward our wife, who was, as 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 says, a gift from God himself. Christ gave us the things we needed, and he still does today generously. And so we ought to be generous when it comes to our wife, if we are following after the ideal, if we are idealists, and we are not content with where we are, but trying to be what we ought to be to them. But he also did something else that impressed me. He had a love that cherishes his bride. Ephesians chapter 5, again, our text. And when I looked that word up, the word means to warm or soften with heat, to foster with tender care. Seems like it's the part of love that lets your wife know that you value her, that you treasure her, that she is incredibly valued by you. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 uses a word that I think means a lot more to me now than it did before, but it's certainly not practiced like it should be many times. He said, "You husbands likewise live with your wives in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of grace." Honor her. That word to the Greeks had the connotation of something very weighty, something very heavy like gold, as opposed to something very light like the steam that would rise up on a mirror in the bathroom or something. The idea of honor is something very weighty, very precious, very valuable to you. And what it seems like to me is that when Paul said that Christ cherishes his bride, he shows her how valuable she is to him. Paul's letters never cease to impress me now with how many times he has all these thankful expressions to the Christians and saints in different churches who were faithfully serving God, showing through Paul how much he was grateful to those who were serving him and following him. James Dobson said in his book that many wives head for the workforce because they find no acknowledgement or appreciation of their work at home. That they go there to find a sense of self-worth. You better know, people, that the popular ideas of our time are out there trying to convince women that they are robbed of true fulfillment of staying at home and being a mother and a homemaker. They are trying to convince her of that, and it is your job to show her that she is valuable and counteract those false ideas that the media is flooding in her mind. And then I thought about Jesus, the one who's running the universe, the one who's holding the world together, the one who's doing greater things than we can ever imagine. And yet he constantly found time to recognize the hard work of his followers and unreservedly commended them for what they did. Kind of tied closely with sacrifice, you know, that we were talking about earlier. That you take time to show your gratefulness to her and how much she's valuable to you, greater, more value than your golf game and your tennis matches. But then also, fourthly, we find in the New Testament that the husband should have a love that understands. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 said, "You husbands likewise live with your wives in an understanding way." And it seemed like the key element to this, the more I thought about it, was in listening and sympathizing and feeling for her and her challenges. Jesus said he understands us. In Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 and 16, that's the wonder of having a high priest like we do. It says that, "For we don't have a high priest who can't sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help in time of need." Can your wife do that to you? Can she draw near and expect to find understanding and sympathy when she needs help and support? I didn't say, could she expect to draw near and get a lecture? That's usually the case. But can she expect to draw near and receive understanding like we can expect to receive from our from Christ, who is the husband of the church? Gary Sandusky said one time, that it was a friend of mine up in Indianapolis or Indiana, said that he made his wife his lifetime research project. That sounded pretty good to me. You spend your whole life trying to understand her and how you can help her. It's not to be something to be derogatory towards her, but it's an effort, a genuine effort on the husband's part to understand his wife and to do what he can to help her and support her in all that she's doing too. But finally, the last thing that seemed to me in the New Testament that characterized the love of Christ toward his bride was that he had a committed love. It's neat, isn't it? That God has always been faithful to His promises that He made to us. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 11. Jesus on the white horse is called faithful and true. He has never left us. We've left Him a lot of times, but He's never deserted us. And isn't that kind of comforting? We kind of take it for granted, but isn't it comforting to know that anytime you need Him, that He's there, He's always going to be faithful to you, always faithful to us? Don't you think there's no more comforting feeling to your wife, to our wives, than to know that we will be there, that when we made a commitment that we would be faithful and honor our commitment to her, that she can count on that at all times, that when times get rough and difficult, that we're not going to run out and leave her because we just can't handle it? Jesus never left us. We've deserted Him. But God is faithful. 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. He is always faithful and righteous to forgive us. Maybe we have been given a reason for divorce. Maybe there's one exception, but I guarantee you, we better think careful about it. God never divorced us. He waits constantly, hoping that we'll come back and repent. Turn back to Him. He's a faithful husband who waits and gives and is patient and has mercy like we need to have. We need to have honor. To honor our commitment to her is to honor our commitment to God. But in conclusion, I guess I'm sure that there's a lot more things that I could say. or could be said. And if I'm invited back in 20 years, I probably would have a lot more to say. But right now, when you've only been married a year and a half, you better stop when you run out of what you found. But if you get nothing else out of this, we need to remember that we need to be husbands that are committed to being ideal, to being like our brother, to be idealists, to be men who are reaching and ever striving and ever pursuing and ever following the model that was given to us. And if we will constantly pattern ourselves after that, and God has promised us in 2 Peter 1 and verse 3, He has promised us that we can partake of that nature and become like Him in our character. If we will pursue that, then we'll have a wonderful marriage, I'm convinced. The question is that our dream for ourselves, the dream that God has for us? May we ever pursue that and try to reach that. Thank you.